Seffi produces my razor from her bag. It is wrapped in sealskin. She lays it on the ground in whip form. The violet smiles, so very pleased. He tries to snatch it up from the ground with a rag from his pocket, but Seffi pulls it back with the seal cloth.
"This is for the gods," I growl, "not their whelps."
Chapter 33 Gods and Men. The priest ushers us through the temple's mouth, where we wait, kneeling on the black stone antechamber inside the mountain. The stone mouth grinds closed behind us. Flames dance in the center of the room, leaping up in a pillar of fire to the onyx ceiling. Acolytes wander through the cavernous temple, chanting softly, draped with black sackcloth hoods.
"Children of the eyes,"
a divine voice finally whispers from the darkness. A synthesizer, like the ones in our demon helms, layers the voice so it seems a dozen sewn together. The invisible gold woman doesn't even bother to use an accent. Fluent as I in their language, but disdainful of the fact, and of the people to which she speaks.
"You come with news?"
"I do, Sunborn."
"Tell us of the ship you saw,"
another voice says, this one a man. Less lofty, more playful.
"You may look upon my face, little child."
Remaining on our knees, we glance up furtively from the ground to see two armored golds deactivating their ghost cloaks. They stand close to us in the dark room. The temple flames dance over their metallic god faces. The man wears a cloak. The woman likely didn't have time to don hers, so eager were they to attend us. The woman plays Freya while the man is dressed as Loki, his metal visage like that of a wolf. Animals can smell fear. Men can't. But those who kill enough can feel the vibrations in that particular silence. I feel them now from Seffi. The gods are true, she's thinking. Ragnar was wrong. We were wrong. But she says nothing. "It bled fire across the sky," I murmur, head down, making great roars, and crashed upon the mountainside.
"You don't say,"
Loki murmurs.
"And is it in one piece, or lots of little itty-bitty pieces, child?"
It is risky saying we saw a ship fall, but I knew no other ruse that would draw the gulls away from their hollow screens in the middle of a rebellion, past the security systems and grey garrison to meet me here. They are peerless scarred, trapped here on the frontier as their world shifts beyond these walls. Once this post would have been considered glamorous, but now it's a form of banishment. I wonder about what crimes or failings brought these peerless scarred here to babysit the wastes.
"The bones of the ship litter the mountain, Sunborn," I explain, looking back at the ground so they do not insist I take away the riding mask that covers my face. The more groveling I do, the less curious I am.
"Broken like a fishing boat, laid upon mid-stern by a breaker. Splinters of iron, splinters of men upon the snow."
I think that's a metaphor the obsidians would use. It passes muster.
"Splinters of men?"
Loki asks.
"Yes, men, but with soft faces, like seal skin in firelight."
Too many metaphors.
"But eyes like hot coals."
I can't stop. How else did Ragnar speak?
"Hair like the gold of your face."
The gold's metal masks remain impassive, communicating to one another over the comms in their helmets.
"Our priest claims you have a weapon of the gods,"
Freya says leadingly. Seffi produces the seal cloth once more, body tense, wondering when I will dispel the magic of the gods as I promised. Her hands tremble. Both golds move closer, the slight ripple of pulse shields evident. I touch them and I fry, They have no fear. Not here on their mountain.
Closer. Closer, you dumb bastards.
Why did you not take this to the leader of your tribe?
Loki asks.
Or to your shaman?
Freya adds suspiciously.
The way of stains is long and hard. To climb all this way just to bring this to us.
We are wanderers,
Mustang says, as Freya bends to look at the blade.
No tribe, no shaman.
Are you, little one?
Loki asks above Sephi, voice hardening.
Then why are there blue tattoos of the Valkyrie on the ankles of that one?
His hand drifts to the razor on his hip.
She was cast out from her tribe, I say, for breaking an oath.
Is it marked with a house sigil?
Loki asks Freya. She reaches for the weapon's hilt in front of me, when Mustang laughs bitterly, drawing her attention.
On the handle, my good lady, Mustang says in Oriat lingo, remaining on her knees as she strips off her mask and tosses it onto the ground. You will find a Pegasus in flight, sigil of the House Andromedus.
Augustus?
Loki sputters, knowing Mustang's face.
I use their surprise and slip forward. By the time they turn back to me, I've snatched the razor out from under Freya's hand and activated the toggle so it is the curved question mark shape that has burned on hillsides, been cut into foreheads, and killed so many of their kind. The same they would have seen on the hollow displays, as I made my speech.
Reaper!
Freya manages, pulling up her pulse fist.
I hack her arm off at the shoulder, then her head at the jaw before hurling my razor straight into Loki's chest. The blade slows as it hits his pulse shield, frozen in midair for half a second as the shield resists. Finally, the blade slips through, but it's slowed and the armor beneath holds. It embeds itself in the pulse armor plate, harmless, until Mustang steps forward and swivel kicks the hilt of the razor. The blade punches through the armor and impales Loki. Both guards fall. Freya to her back, Loki to his knees.
Mask off!
Mustang barks as Loki's hands wrap around the blade sticking from his chest. She slaps his hand away from his datapad.
No comms!
Holiday strips the razor from the man's hip as his pulse shield shorts. I take Freya's razor from her corpse.
Do it!
Sephi and her Valkyries stare wide-eyed from their knees at the blood pooling beneath Freya. I remove Freya's helmet from her head to reveal the mangled face of a middle-aged, peerless, scarred woman with dark skin and almond-shaped eyes.
Does this look like a god to you, Sephi?
I ask. Mustang snorts a dark little laugh when Loki removes his mask.
Darrow, look who it is. Proctor Mercury.
The pudgy, cherub-faced, peerless scarred who endeavoured to recruit me into his own house at the Institute before Fitchner stole me away. When last we saw each other 5 years ago, he tried to duel me in the halls as my howler stormed Olympus. I shot him in the chest with a pulse fist. He smiled all the while. He's not smiling now as he stares at the metal in his chest. I feel a pang of pity.
Proctor Mercury, I say, you have to be the least lucky gold I've ever met. 2 mountains lost to a red.
Reaper! You have to be shitting me.
He shudders in pain and laughs at his own surprise.
But you're on Phobos.
Negative, my goodman. That'd be my diminutive psychotic accomplice.
Gory damn it.
He looks at the blade in his chest, grunting as he sits on his haunches and wheezes out breaths.
How did we not see you?
Quicksilver hacked your system, I say.
You're here for...
His voice trails away as he looks at the Valkyrie rising to gather around the dead god. Persephone bends over Freya. The pale warrior traces her fingers over the woman's face as Holiday strips off her armor. "For them," I say. "Bloody damn right I am."
"Oh, gory hell. Augustus,"
our old proctor says, turning to Mustang with a bitter laugh.
"You can't do this. It's madness. They're monsters. You can't let them out. Do you know what will happen? Don't open Pandora's box."
If they are monsters, we should ask ourselves who made them that way. Mustang says in the obsidian tongue, so Sephi can understand. "Now, what are the codes to Asgard's armory?" He spits.
"You'll have to ask nicer than that, traitor."
Mustang is deadly cold. "Treason is a matter of the date, Proctor. Must I ask again, or must I begin trimming your ears?" Beside Freya's body, Sephi dips her finger into the blood and tastes it. "Just blood," I say, crouching beside her. "Not ichor, not divine, human." I hold out Freya's razor for her to take. She flinches at the idea, but forces herself to wrap her fingers around the hilt, hands trembling, expecting to be struck by lightning or electrocuted like men are who touch pulse shields with bare hands. "This button here retracts the whip. This one controls the shape." She cradles the weapon reverently and looks up at me, furious eyes asking which shape she should conjure. I nod to mine, trying to build kinship with her. And I do, if only in this martial way. Slowly, her razor takes the shape of the sling blade. The skin on my arm prickles as the Valkyrie laugh to one another. Vibrating with excitement, they pull their own axes and long knives and look at me and Mustang. "There's 5 gods left," Mustang says. "How'd you ladies like to meet them?" Chapter 34 God Killers. We drag the bodies of 7 gods, 2 dead and 5 captured, behind us. I wear the armor of Odin, Sephi the armor of Tyr, Mustang the armor of Freya, all of which we pillaged from the armory on Asgard. Blood smears the stone of the hall. Feet slide and stumble as Sephi jerks one of the living gulls behind us by his hair. Her Valkyrie dragged the rest. We returned to the spires on a shuttle stolen from Asgard, which we slipped through silently, using Loki's codes to access the armory and drape ourselves in the panoply of war before seeking the remaining gods out. 2 we found in Asgard's mainframe, leading a team of greens attempting to purge Quicksilver's hackers from their system. Sephi, with her new razor, claimed the arm of one and beat the other unconscious, terrifying the greens, 2 of which held up fists to me as silent acknowledgement of their sympathy for the Rising. With their help, we locked the others in a storage room, as the 2 green sympathizers connected me directly with Quicksilver's operation room. We didn't reach Quicksilver himself, but Vitra relayed news that Severo's gamble worked. A little more than a third of the Martian defense fleet is under control of the Sons of Ares and Quicksilver's Blues. Thousands of the Society's best troops are trapped on Phobos, but the Jackal is hitting back hard, taking personal command of the remaining ships and recalling forces from the Kuiper Belt to reinforce his depleted fleet. The rest of the golds we located through the station's biometric sensor map in the lower levels. One practicing with her razor in the training rooms. She saw my face and dropped her blade in surrender. Reputation is a fine thing sometimes. The remaining two golds we found in the monitoring bays, shifting back and forth between the cameras. They'd only just discovered that the footage was archival from 3 years before. Now, all our gold captives wear magnetic handcuffs and are tied together by long pieces of rope from Seffi's griffin, all gagged, all glancing around at the spires like we've dragged them into the mouth of hell itself. Obsidians of the spires flock to us in the halls, rushing from the deeper levels to see the strange sight. Most would only have seen their gods from a distance, as flashes of gold streaking over the spring snow at Mach 3. Now we come among them, our pulse shields distorting the air, our shuttle's pulse cannons melting open the huge iron doors which closed off the Griffin hangar from the cold. The doors melt inward like the door on the Pax melted when Ragnar offered me Stains. This is not how I intended to bring the Obsidians into my fold. I wanted to use words, to come humbly, in sealskin, not armor, putting myself at the mercy of the Obsidians to show Alia that I valued her people's worth, valued their judgment, and was willing to put myself in peril for them. I wanted to do as I preached. But even Ragnar knew that was a fool's errand. And now I don't have time for intransigence or superstition. If Alia will not follow me to war, I'll drag her to it, kicking, screaming, like Lorne before her. For Obsidian to hear, I must speak in the only language they understand. Might. Seffi fires her pulse fist past my head at the doors leading to our mother's sanctuary. The ancient iron buckles, bent and twisted hinges screaming. We flow past an army of prostrate giants who clutter the cavernous halls to either side. So much strength made frail by superstition. Once, when they were stronger, they tried to cross the seas, built mighty canals to carry explorers across the oceans to seek out new lands. The carved monsters the gold sowed in the oceans destroyed each boat, or the golds themselves melted them from the sea. The last boat sailed more than 200 years ago. We come upon Alia as she sits in council with her famed 77 war chiefs. They turn to us now amidst large smoking braziers. Huge warriors with white hair to the waists, arms bare, iron buckles on waists, huge axes on backs. Black eyes and rings studded with precious metals glitter in the low light. But they're too stunned by the sight of the 300-year-old iron doors suddenly glowing orange and melting away to speak or kneel. I draw up before them, still dragging the corpses of the golds behind me. Mustang and Seffi hurl their captured golds forward, kicking out their legs. They sprawl on the ground and stumble to their feet, attempting beyond all reason to maintain some dignity here, surrounded by giant savages in the smoky room. "Are these gods?" I roar through my helmet. No one answers. Alia moves slowly through the parting warlords. "Am I a god?" I snarl, this time removing my helmet. Mustang and Seffi remove theirs. Alia sees her daughter in the armor of her gods, and she flinches back. Fear whispers over her lips. She stops near the 5 bound and gagged golds as they finally find their feet. They stand over 2 meters tall, but even bent and old as Alia is, she's a head taller than I. She stares down at the men and women who are once her gods, before looking up at her last daughter.
"Child, what have you done?"
Seffi says nothing, but the razor on her arm slithers, drawing the eyes of every Obsidian. One of their greatest daughters carries the weapon of the gods.
Queen of the Valkyrie, I say, as if we had never met. My name is Darrow of Lycos, blood brother of Ragnar Valaris. I am the warlord of the Rising, which rages against the false golden gods. You have all seen the fires that rage around the moon. Those are caused by my army. Beyond this land, in the abyss, a war rages between slaves and masters. I came here with the greatest son of the spires to bring the truth to your people. I wave to the golds, who stare at me with the hatred of an entire race. They struck him down before he could tell you that you are slaves. The prophets he sent told it true. Your gods are false.
Liar!
Someone screams. A shaman with crooked knees and a bent spine. He babbles something else, but Sephi cuts him off.
Liar!
Mustang hisses. I have stood upon Asgard. I have seen where your immortals sleep. Where your immortals rot and eat and shit. She twists the pulse fist in her hand. This is not magic. She activates her grav boots, floating in the air. The obsidians stare at her in wonder. This is not magic. This is a tool. Alia sees what I have done, what I have shown her daughter, and what I have now brought her people, whether she wants it or not. We're the same cruel kind. I told myself I would be better than this. I failed that promise. But noble vanity can shine another day. This is war, and victory is the only nobility. I think that is what Mustang was looking for here with obsidians. She was more afraid that I would allow my own idealism let something loose that I could not control. But now she sees the compromise I'm willing to make, the strength I'm willing to exert. That's what she wants in an ally, as much as she wants a builder, someone wise enough to adapt. And Alia? She sees how her people look at me, how they look at my blade, still stained with the blood of the gods, as though it were some holy relic. And she also knows I could have made her complicit in the gold's crime, could have accused her before her people, but instead I offer her a chance to pretend she is just learning this for the first time. Lamentably, my friend's mother does not take the offer. She steps toward Sephi.
I carried you, birthed you, nursed you. And this is my reward? Treason? Blasphemy? You are no Valkyrie.
She looks at her people.
These are lies. Free our gods from the usurpers. Kill blasphemers. Kill them all.
But before the first war chief can even draw their blade, Sephi steps forward, lifts the razor I gave her, and decapitates her mother. Alia's head falls to the floor. Eyes still open. The woman's huge body remains standing. Slowly it tips backward and thuds to the ground. Sephi stands over the fallen queen and spits on the corpse. Turning back to her people, she speaks for the first time in 25 years.
She knew.
Her voice is deep and dangerous, hardly rising above the level of a whisper, yet it owns the room as surely as if she roared. Then tall Sephi turns away from the golds, walks back through the gaggle of war chiefs to the griffin throne, where her mother's fabled war chest has sat unopened for 10 years. There, she bends and takes the lock in her hands and roars gutturally, like a beast, as she pulls at the rusted iron till her fingers bleed,
and the iron crumbles apart. She throws the old lock to the ground and rips open the chest, pulling free the old black scarab skin her mother used to conquer the White Coast. Pulling free the red scale cloak of the dragon her mother slew in her youth, and hoisting high her great black double-headed axe of war called Throgmir. The rippling gleam of durosteel catches in the light. She stalks back to the golds, dragging the axe on the ground behind her. She motions to Holiday, who removes the gags from the mouths of the golds.
"Are you a god?"
Sethi asks,
a tone so different from her brother's, direct and cold as a winter storm.
"You will burn, mortal," the man says. "If you do not release us, Aesir will come from the sky and rain fire upon your land. This you know. We will wipe your seed from the worlds. We will melt the ice. We are the mighty. We are the peerless Skard. And this millennium belongs to—"
Sephi slays him there with one giant swing, cleaving him nearly in twain.
Blood sprays my face. I do not flinch. I knew what would happen if I brought them here. I also know there's no way I could keep them as prisoners.
The golds built this myth, but now it must die.
Mustang moves closer to me, her sign that she accepts this, but her eyes are fixed on the golds. She will remember this slaughter for the rest of her life. It is her duty and mine to make it mean something. Part of me mourns the death of these golds. Even as they die, they make these other, taller mortals still seem so much lesser. They stand straight, proud. They do not quake in their last moment, in this smoky room so far from their estates, where they rode horses as children, and learned the poetry of Keats, and the wonder of Beethoven, and Vollmer. A middle-aged gold woman looks back at Mustang.
"You let them do this to us?
I fought for your father.
I met you when you were a girl.
And I fell in his reign." She glares at me and begins to recite with a loud, clear voice the Aeschylus poem the peerless Skard use at times as a battle cry.
"Up and lead the dance of fate. Lift the song that mortals hate. Tell what rights are ours on earth, over all of human birth. Swift of foot to avenge are we, he whose hands are clean and pure. Naught our wrath to dread hath he."
One by one they fall to Sephi's axe, until only the woman is left, her head held high, her words ringing clear. She looks me in the eye, as sure of her right as I am of mine.
"Sacrifice, obedience, prosperity."
Sephi's axe sweeps through the air, and the last god of Asgard flops to the stone floor. Over her body towers the blood-spattered princess of the Valkyrie, terrible and ancient with her justice. She bends and removes the tongue of the female gold with a crooked knife. Mustang shifts beside me in discomfort. Sephi smiles, noticing Mustang's unease, and walks away from us to her dead mother. She takes the woman's crown and ascends the steps to the throne, bloody axe in one hand, glass crown in the other, and sits inside the ribcage of the griffin, where she crowns herself.
"Children of the spires, the Reaper has called us to join him in his war against false gods. Do the Valkyrie answer?"
In reply, her Valkyrie raise their blue-feathered axes high above their heads to drone out the obsidian chant of death. Even the war chiefs of fallen Alia join. It seems the ocean itself crashes through the stone hallways of the spires, and I feel the drums of war beating inside, chilling my blood.
Then ride, Hjelda, Tharul, Veni, and Hroga. Ride, Faldir, and Urona, and Bolga, to the tribes of the Blood Coast, to the Bleaking Moor, the Shattered Spine and the Witch Pass. Ride to kin and enemy alike, and tell them Sephi speaks. Tell them Ragnar's prophets told true. Asgard has fallen. The gods are dead. The old oaths have been broken. And tell all who will hear. The Valkyrie ride to war.
As the world swirls around us, and the ecstasy of war fills the air, Mustang and I look at one another with darkened eyes and wonder just what we have unleashed. Part 3. Glory. All that we have is that shout into the wind, how we live, how we go, and how we stand before we fall. Carnos au Bellona. Chapter 35. The Light. For 7 days after the death of Ragnar, I travel across the ice with Sephi, speaking to the male tribes of the Broken Spine, to the blooded braves of the North Coast, to women who wear the horns of rams and stand watch over the Witch Pass. Flying in grav boots beside the Valkyrie, we come bringing the news of the fall of Asgard. It is dramatic. Sephi and a score of her Valkyrie have begun training with Holiday and me to learn to use the grav boots and pulse weapons. They're clumsy at first. One flew into the side of a mountain at Mach 2. But when 30 land with their headdresses kicking in the wind, the left of their faces painted with the blue handprint of Sephi the Quiet, and the right with the sling blade of the Reaper, folks tend to listen. We take the lion's share of obsidian leaders to the conquered mountain and let them walk the halls where their gods ate and slept, and show them the cold, preserved corpses of the slain golds. In seeing their gods slain, most, even those who knew tacitly of their true condition as slaves, accepted our olive branch. Those who did not, who denounced us, were overcome by their own people. Two war chiefs hurled themselves from the mountain in shame. Another opened her veins with a dagger and bleeds out on the floor of the greenhouses. And one, a particularly psychotic little woman, watched with great malevolence as we took her to the mountain's data hub, where three greens informed her of a planned coup against her rule, showing her video of the conspiracy. We loaned her a razor, a flight back home, and 2 days later she added 20,000 warriors to my cause. Sometimes I encounter Ragnar's legend. It has spread among the tribes. They call him the Speaker, the one who came with truth, who brought the prophets and sacrificed his life for his people. But with my friend's legend grows my own. My sling blade symbol burns across the mountainsides to greet me and the Valkyrie when we fly to meet with new tribes. They call me the Morning Star. That star by which griffin riders and travelers navigate the wastes in the dark months of winter. The last star that disappears when daylight returns in the spring. It is my legend that begins to bind them, not their sense of kinship with one another. These clans have warred for generations, but I have no sordid history here. Unlike Sephi or the other great obsidian warlords, I am their untouched field of snow, their blank slate on which they can project whatever disparate dreams they have. As Mustang says, I am something new, and in this old world, steeped in legends ancestors and what came before, something new is something very special. Yet despite our progress with gathering the clans, the difficulty we face is massive. Not only must we keep the fractious obsidians from killing one another in honor duels, but many of the clans have accepted my invitation for relocation. Hundreds of thousands of them must be brought from their homes in the Antarctic to the tunnels of the Reds, so they are beyond the reach of gold bombardment, which will come when the Golds discover what has transpired here. All this while keeping the Jackal dumb and blind to our maneuvers. From Asgard, Mustang has led the counterintelligence efforts, with the help of Quicksilver's hackers, to mask our presence and project reports consistent with those filed in previous weeks to the Board of Quality Control HQ in Aegea. With no way to move them without someone noticing, Mustang, a gold aristocrat, has conceived the most audacious plan in the history of the Sons of Ares. One massive troop movement, utilizing thousands of shuttles and freighters from Quicksilver's mercantile fleet and the Sons of Ares Navy, to move the population of the Pole in 12 hours. 1,000 ships skimming over the southern sea, burning helium, to set down on the ice before obsidian cities and lower their ramps to the hundreds and thousands of giants swaddled in fur and iron, who will fill their hulls with the old, the sick, the warriors, the children, and the fetid stink of animals. Then, under the cover of the Sons of Ares ships, the population will be dispersed underground, and many of the warriors to our military ships in orbit. I do not think I know another person in the worlds who can organize it as fast as she does. On the 8th day after the fall of Asgard, I depart with Sephi, Mustang, Holiday, and Cassius to join Sevro in overseeing the final preparations for the migration. The Valkyrie bring Ragnar with us on the flight, wrapping his frozen body in rough cloth and clutching him close in terror as our ship cruises just beneath the speed of sound, 5 meters from the surface of the ocean. They watch in awe as we enter the tunnels of Mars through one of the many sun's subterranean access points. This one, an old mining colony in a southern mountain range. Sun's lookouts in heavy winter jackets and balaclavas salute with their fists in the air as we pass into the tunnel. 30 minutes of subterranean flying later, we arrive at Tinos. It is a hub of ship activity, hundreds cluttering the stalactite docks, taxiing through the air, and it seems the whole city watches our shuttle as it passes through the traffic to land in its stalactite hangar, knowing it bears not just me and our new obsidian allies, but the broken shield of Tinos. Their weeping faces blur past. Already rumors swirl through the refugees. The obsidians are coming, not just to fight, but to live in Tinos, to eat their food, to share their already crowded streets. Dancer says the place is a powder keg about to erupt. I can't say I disagree. The disposition of the Sons of Ares is dour. They gather in silence as my ship's landing ramp unfurls. I go first down the ramp. Sevro waits beside Dancer and Mickey. He slams me into a hug. The beginnings of a goatee mark his stoic face. He holds his shoulders as square as he can, as if those bony things alone could hold up the hopes of the thousands of Sons of Ares who filled the docking bay to see the shield of Tinos brought back to his adopted home. "Where is he?" Sevro asks thickly. I look back into my shuttle as Sephi and her Valkyrie carry Ragnar down the ramp. The Howlers are the first to greet them, Clown saying a respectful word to Sephi as Sevro steps past me to stand before the Valkyrie. "Welcome to Tinos," he says to the Valkyrie in Nagal. "I am Sevro Aubarka, blood brother to Ragnar Valaris. These are his other brothers and sisters." He motions to the Howlers, all of whom wear their wolf cloaks. Sevro produces Ragnar's bear cloak.
He wore this to battle. With your permission, I'd like him to wear it now.
You were brother to Ragnar. You are brother to me,
Sefi says. She clicks her tongue, and her Valkyrie pass stewardship of her brother's body to Severo. Mustang glances my way. Sefi's generosity strikes me as a promising sign. If she were a covetous creature, she would have kept his body in her lands and given him an obsidian funeral pyre before burying his ashes in the ice. Instead, she told me she knows where his true home lies, with those who fought beside him, who helped him come back to his people. Mustang moves closer beside me as the howlers drape Ragnar's cloak over his body and carry him through the crowd. The suns part for them. Hands reach to touch Ragnar.
Look, Mustang says, nodding to the thin black ribbons that the suns have tied into their beards and hair.
Her hand finds my smallest finger. A small squeeze sends me back to the woods where she saved me, making me feel warm, even as we watch Severo leave the hangar with Ragnar's body.
Go.
She nudges me his direction. Dancer and I have a conference scheduled with Quicksilver and Victra. She needs a guard, I tell Dancer. Sons you trust.
I'll be fine,
Mustang says, rolling her eyes. I survived the obsidians. She'll have the pit vipers, Dancer says. Examining Mustang without the kindness I'm used to seeing in his eyes. Ragnar's death has taken the spirit out of him today. He seems older as he waves Nair all over and nods to the shuttle. The Bellona on board? Holiday's got him in the passenger cabin. His neck's still torn up, so he'll need Virini to take a look at him.
Be discreet about it. Give him a private room.
Private? Place is crammed, Darrow. Captains don't even get private rooms.
He's got intel.
You want him shot before he can give it to us? I ask. Is that why you kept him alive? Dancer looks at Mustang skeptically, as if she's already compromising my decisions. Little does he know, she'd have let Cassius die more readily than I ever would. Dancer sighs when I don't relent. He'll be safe. On my word.
Find me later, Mustang says, as I depart.
I find Severo slumped over Ragnar in Mickey's laboratory. It's a thing to hear of a friend's death. It's another to see the shadow of what they've left behind. I hated the sight of my father's old work gloves after he died. Mother was too practical to throw them away, said we couldn't afford to. So I did it myself one day, and she boxed my ears and made me bring them back. The scent of death is growing stronger from Ragnar. The cold preserved him in his native land, but Tinos has been suffering power outages and refrigeration units play second zither to the water purifiers and air reclamation systems in the city beneath. Soon Mickey will embalm him and make preparations for the burial Ragnar asked for. I sit in silence for half an hour, waiting for Severo to speak. I don't want to be here. Don't want to see Ragnar dead. Don't want to linger in the sadness. Yet I stay for Severo. My armpits stink. I'm tired. The scanty tray of food Dio brought me is untouched except the biscuit I chew numbly, and think how ridiculous Ragnar looks on the table. He's too big for it, feet hanging off the edge. Despite the smell, Ragnar is peaceful in death. Ribbons red as winter berries nestled in the white of his beard. Two razors rest in his hands, which are folded across his bare chest. The tattoos are darker in death, covering his arms, his chest and neck. The matching skull he gave me and Severo seems so sad, telling its story, even though the man who wears it is dead.
Everything is more vivid except the wound. It's innocuous and thin as a snake's smile along his side. The holes Azja made in his stomach seem so small. How could such little things take so large a soul from this world? I wish he were here. The people need him more than ever. Severo's eyes are glassy, and his fingers glide over the tattoos on Ragnar's white face.
He wanted to go to Venus, you know,
he murmurs, voice soft as a child's, softer than I've ever heard it before. I showed him one of the holovids of a catamaran there. Second he put the goggles on, I'd never seen anyone smile like that. Like he'd found heaven, and realized he didn't have to die to go there. He'd sneak in and borrow my hollow gear in the middle of the night, till one day I just gave him the damn thing. Things are 400 credits, max. Know what he did to repay me? I don't. Severo holds up his right hand to show me his skull tattoo. He made me his brother. He gives Ragnar a slow, affectionate punch to the jaw. But the big fat idiot had to run at Azja instead of away from her. The Valkyries still scour the wastes in vain for signs of the Olympic night. Her trail goes deeper into the crevasse before it is covered by the frozen black blood of some creature. I hope something found her and took her to its cave in the ice to finish her slowly. But I doubt it. A woman like that doesn't just fade. Whatever Azja's fate, if she's alive, she'll find a way to contact the Sovereign or the Jackal. It was my fault, I say. My shit plan to take Azja out. She killed Quinn. Helped kill my father, Severo mutters. Killed dozens of us when you were locked up. Wasn't your bet. You'd have lost me, too, if I were there. Even Rags couldn't have kept me from having a go at her. Severo rolls his knuckles along the edge of the table, leaving little white creases in the skin. Always trying to protect us. The shield of Tinos, I say. The shield of Tinos, he echoes, voice catching. He loved the name. I know. I think he'd always thought himself a blade before he met us. We let him be what he wanted. A protector. He wipes his eyes and backs away from Ragnar. Anyway, the little princeling is alive. I nod. We brought him on the shuttle. Pity. 2 millimeters. He pinches his fingers together, illustrating how narrowly Mustang's arrow missed Cassius's jugular. After Sephi dispatched riders to the tribes, I took her and many of her warriors to Asgard aboard the shuttle to see the fortress there. I brought Cassius along as well, and Asgard's yellows saved his life.
Why are you keeping him alive, Darrow? If you think he's going to thank you for your generosity, you've got another thing coming.
I couldn't just let him die.
He killed my father.
I know.
Give me a reason.
Maybe I think the world would be a better place with him in it, I say tentatively. So many people have used him, lied to him, betrayed him. All that's defined him. It's not fair. I want him to have a chance to decide for himself what kind of person he wants to be.
None of us get to be what we want to be,
Severo mutters. At least not for long.
Isn't that why we fight? Isn't that what you just said about Ragnar? He was made a blade, but we gave him a chance to be a shield. Cassius deserves that same chance.
Shithead. He rolls his eyes. Just 'cause you're right doesn't mean you're right. Anyway, eagles are hated as much as the lions. Someone here is still going to try to pop him,
And your girl, too. She's got the pit vipers with her. And she's not my girl.
Whatever you say.
He collapses into one of Mickey's stolen leather chairs and rubs a hand along his mohawk's ridge. Wish she'd taken the telemanuses with her. If she had, you'd have slagged Azure hard. He closed his eyes and leans his head back. Oh, hey! He remembers suddenly. I got you some ships.
I saw that.
Thank you, I say.
Finally!
He snorts a laugh. A sign we're making a difference. 20 torchships, 10 frigates, 4 destroyers, a dreadnought. You should have seen it, Reap. Martian Navy pumped Phobos full of legionnaires, emptied their ships, and we just stole their assault shuttles, flew them back with the right codes, and landed them in their hangars. My squad didn't even fire a shot. Quicksilver's boys even hacked the PA systems and the Navy ships. They all heard your speech. It was mutiny almost before we got on board. Reds, oranges, blues, even greys. It won't work again, the PA system bit. Golds will learn to cut themselves off the network so we can't hack in. But it got him hard this week. When we reunite with the Pax and Orion's other ships, we'll have a real force to slag the pixies.
It's moments like this that I know I'm not alone. Damn the world, so long as I have my mangy little guardian angel. If only I was so good at guarding him as he is at guarding me. Once again, he's done all I could ask, and more. As I marshaled the obsidians, he ripped a gaping hole in the Jackal's defense fleet, crippled a fourth of them, forced the rest to retreat toward the outer moon of Deimos to regroup with the Jackal's reserves and await additional reinforcements from Ceres and the Khan. For a brief hour, he held naval supremacy over all of Mars's southern hemisphere. The Goblin King. Then he was forced to retreat to hunker close into Phobos, where his men eliminated the trapped loyalist marines by using Rolo's squads to cut off their air and vent them into space. I'm under no delusion. The Jackal won't let us have the moon. He might not care about its people, but he can't destroy the station's helium refineries. So another assault will come soon. It won't affect my war effort, but the Jackal will get tied down fighting the populace that we've woken. It'll drain his resources without trapping me. Worst possible situation for him. What are you thinking? I ask Severo. His eyes are lost in the ceiling. I'm wondering how long till it's us on the slab. And wondering why it's got to be us on the line. You see vids and hear stories and you think of the regular people. The ones who got a chance at life on Ganymede or Earth or Luna. Can't help but be jealous.
You don't think you've gotten a chance to live? I ask.
Not proper, he says.
What's proper? I ask. He crosses his arms like he's a kid in a fort, looking down at the real world and wondering why it can't be as magical as he is.
I don't know. Something far away from being a peerless scard. Maybe a pixie, or even a happy mid-color. I just want something to look at and say, that's safe. That's mine. And no one is going to try and take it. A house. Kids.
Kids? I ask.
I don't know. I never thought of it till Pops died. Till they took you.
Till Victra, you mean?
I say with a wink.
Nice goatee, by the way.
Shut up, he says.
Have you two...
He cuts me off, changing the subject.
But it'd be nice to just be Severo. To have Pops. To have known my mother.
He laughs at himself, harder than he should.
Sometimes I think about going back to the beginning and wondering what would have happened if Pops had known the board was coming. If he'd escaped with my mother, with me.
I nod.
I always think about how life would have been like if Io never died. The children I would have had, what I would have named them. I smiled distantly. I would have grown old, watched Io grow old, and I would have loved her more with each new scar, with each new year, even as she learned to despise our small life. I would have said farewell to my mother, maybe my brother, sister, and if I was lucky, one day, when Io's hair turned grey, before it began to fall out and she began to cough, I would hear the shift of rocks over my head on the drill, and that would be it. She would have sent me to the incinerators and sprinkled my ashes. Then our children would have done the same. And the clans would say we were happy and good and raised bloody damn fine children. And when those children died, our memory would fade. And when their children died, it would be swept away, like the dust we become, down and away to the long tunnels. It would have been a small life, I say with a shrug, but I would have liked it. And every day I ask myself, if I was given the chance to go back, to be blind, to have all that back, would I? And what's the answer? All this time I thought this was for Io. I drove straight on like an arrow because I had that one perfect idea in my head. She wanted this. I loved her, so I'll make her dream real. But that's bullshit. I was living half a bloody damn life, making an idol out of a woman, making her a martyr, something instead of someone, pretending she was perfect. I run my hand through my greasy hair. She wouldn't have wanted that. And when I looked out at the hollows, I just knew. I mean, I guess I realized, as I was talking, that justice isn't about fixing the past. It's about fixing the future. We're not fighting for the dead. We're fighting for the living. And for those who aren't yet born. For a chance to have children. That's what has to come after this. Otherwise, what's the point? Severo sits silently, thinking over what I've said. You and I keep looking for light in the darkness, expecting it to appear. But it already has. I touch his shoulder. We're it, boyo. Broken and cracked and stupid as we are, we're the light, and we're spreading. Chapter 36 Swill. I run into Victor in the hall as I leave Severo with Ragnar. It's late, past midnight, and she's only just arrived to help coordinate the final preparations between Quicksilver Security, the Suns, and our new Navy, which I've given her command of until we're reunited with Orion. It's another decision that peeves Dancer. He's frightened I'm bestowing too much power on Golds who might have ulterior motives. Mustang's presence could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. How's he doing? Victra asks regarding Severo. Better, I say, but he'll be glad to see you. She smiles at that, despite herself, and I think she actually blushes. It's a new look for her. Where are you going? She asks. To make sure Mustang and Dancer haven't torn each other's heads off yet. Noble, but too late. What happened? Is everything prime? That's relative, I suppose. Dancer's in the war room, ranting about gold superiority complexes, arrogance, etc. Never heard him curse so much. I didn't stay long, and he didn't say much. You know, he's not that sweet on me. And you're not that sweet on Mustang, I say. I have nothing against the girl. She reminds me of home.
especially considering the new allies you've brought us. I just think she's a duplicitous little filly, that's all.
But it's the best horses that'll buck you right off, don't you think?
I laugh. Not sure if that was innuendo or not.
It was.
Do you know where she is?
Victra makes a sad little face.
Contrary to popular opinion, I don't know everything, darling.
She moves past me to join Severo, patting my head as she goes.
But I'd check the commissary on level 3 if I were you.
Where are you going? I ask.
She smiles mischievously. Mind your own business.
I find Mustang in the commissary, hunched over a metal bottle with Uncle Nero, Kavax, and Daxo. A dozen members of the Pit Vipers lounge at the other tables, smoking burners and eavesdropping intently to Mustang, who sits with her boots up on the table, using Daxo as a backrest, as she tells a story about the Institute to the other two occupants of the table. I couldn't see them when I first entered, due to the bulk of the telemanuses, but my brother and mother sit listening to the tale. And so, of course, I shout for Pax.
That's my son, Kavax reminds my mother.
And he comes on over the hill, leading a column of my house members. Darrow and Cassius feel the ground shaking and go screaming into the lock where they clung together for hours, shivering and turning blue.
Blue,
Kavax says, with a huge childish laugh that makes the sons eavesdropping unable to keep their composure. Even if he's a gold, it's difficult not to like Kavax, our Telemanus.
Blue as blueberries, Sophocles. Isn't that right?
Give him another, Diana.
My mother rolls a jelly bean across the table to Sophocles, who waits eagerly beside the bottle to gobble it up.
What's going on here? I ask, eyeing the bottle my brother's refilling the gold's mugs with.
We're getting stories from the lass,
Nero says gruffly through a cloud of burner smoke.
Have a dram.
Mustang wrinkles her nose at the smoke.
Such an awful habit, Nero, she says.
Kieran looks pointedly at our mother. I've been telling both of them that for years.
Hello, Darrow, Daxo says, standing to clasp my arm. Pleasure to see you without a razor in your hand this time.
He pokes me in the shoulder with a long finger. Daxo, sorry about all that. I think I owe you a bit of a debt for taking care of my people.
Orion did most of the minding there, he says with a twinkle in his eye. He returns gracefully to his seat. My brother's captivated by the man and the angels tattooed on his head. And how could he not be?
Daxos twice his weight, immaculate, and more well-mannered than even a rose-like Mateo, who I hear is recovering well on one of Quicksilver's ships, and is delighted to know I'm alive.
What happened with Dancer? I ask Mustang.
Her cheeks are flushed, and she laughs at the question.
Well, I don't think he very much likes me. But don't worry, he'll come around.
Are you drunk? I ask with a laugh.
A little. Catch up.
She swivels her legs down and puts her feet on the ground to clear a space on the bench beside her.
I was just getting to the part where you wrestled Pax in the mud.
My mother watches me quietly, a little smile on her lips as she knows the panic that must be going through me right now. Too shocked at seeing two halves of my life collide without my supervision, I sit down uneasily and listen to Mustang finish the story. With all that's transpired, I'd forgotten the charm of this woman, her easy, light nature, how she draws others in by making them feel important, by saying their names and letting them feel seen. She holds my uncle and brother in a spell, one reinforced by the Telemanus's admiration for her. I try not to blush when my mother catches me admiring Mustang.
But enough of the Institute, Mustang says, after she's explained in detail how Pax and I dueled in front of her castle. Diana, you promised me a story about Darrow as a boy.
How about the gas pocket one? Nerol says. If only Lauren was here.
No, not that one, Kieran says. What about... I have one, Mother says, cutting off the men. She begins slow, words sluggish through the lisp. When Darrow was small, maybe 3 or 4, his father gave him an old watch his father had given him. This brass thing, with a wheel instead of digital numbers. Do you remember it?
I nod.
It was beautiful. Your favourite possession. And years later, after his father had died, Kieran here got sick with a cough. Meds were always in short ration in the mines, so you'd have to get them from Gamma or Grey. But each has a price. I didn't know how I was going to pay. And then Darrow comes home one day with the medicine. Won't say how he got it. But several weeks later, I saw one of the Greys checking the time with that old watch.
I look at my hands, but I feel Mustang's eyes on me.
I think it's time for bed, Mother says.
Nerol and Kieran protest until she clears her throat and stands.
She kisses me on the head, lingering longer than she usually would.
Then she touches Mustang's shoulder and limps from the room with my brother's help. Nerol's men go with them.
She's a quiet woman, Kavak says, and she loves you very much.
I'm glad you met like this, I say to him, then to Mustang, especially you.
How's that? She asks,
without me trying to control it. Like last time.
Yes, I would say that was quite the disaster, Daxo says.
This feels right, I say.
I agree. It does.
Mustang smiles.
I wish I could introduce you to mine. You would have liked her better than my father.
I return the smile, wondering what this is between us. Dreading the idea of having to define it. There's an easiness that comes with being around her, but I'm afraid to ask her what she's thinking, afraid to broach the subject for fear of shattering this little illusion of peace.
Kavax awkwardly clears his throat, dissolving the moment.
So the meeting with Dancer didn't go well? I ask.
I fear not. Daxo says. The resentment he harbours runs deep. Theodora was more forthcoming, but Dancer was intransigent. Militantly so.
He's a cipher, Mustang clarifies, taking another drink and wincing at the quality of proof.
Hoarding information from us. Wouldn't share anything I didn't already know.
I doubt you were very forthcoming yourself.
She grimaces. No, but I'm used to making others compensate for me.
He's smart, and that means it's going to be difficult to convince him that I want our alliance to work.
So you do.
Thanks to your family, yes, she says. You want to build a world for them, for your mother, for Kieran's children. I understand that.
When I chose to negotiate with the Sovereign, I was trying to do the same thing, protecting those I love.
The Telemannises share a glance. Her finger traces dents in the table.
I couldn't see a world without war unless we capitulated.
Her eyes find my sigil-barren hands, searching the naked flesh there, as if it held the secret to all our futures.
Maybe it does. But I can see one now.
You really mean that? I ask.
All of you.
Family is all that matters, Kavok says. And you are family.
Daxo sets an elegant hand on my shoulder. Even Sophocles seems to understand the gravity of the moment, resting his chin on my foot beneath the table.
Aren't you?
Yes. I nod gratefully. I am. With a tight smile, Mustang pulls a piece of paper from her pocket and slides it to me. That's Orion's comm frequency. I don't know where they are. Probably in the belt. I gave them a simple directive. Cause chaos. From what I've heard from Gold's chatter, they're doing just that. We'll need her and her ships if we're going to take down Octavia. Thank you, I say to them all. I didn't think we'd ever have a second chance.
Nor did we, Daxo replies. Let me be blunt with you, Darrow. There is a matter of concern. It's your plan. You're designed to use claw drills to allow the Obsidians to invade key cities around Mars. We think it is a mistake.
Really? I ask. Why? We need to wrest the Jackal's centers of power away, gain traction with the populace.
Father and I do not have the same faith in the Obsidians you seem to have,
Daxo says carefully.
Your intentions will matter little if you let them loose on the populace of Mars.
Barbarians, Kavok says. They are barbarians.
Ragnar's sister
is not Ragnar, Daxo replies. She's a stranger. And after hearing what she did to the Gold prisoners,
we can't in good conscience join our forces to a plan that would unleash the Obsidians on the cities of Mars. The Arcos women won't either.
I see.
And there's another reason we think the plan flawed, Mustang says. It doesn't deal properly with my brother. Give my brother credit. He's smarter than you, smarter than me.
Even Kavax does not contest this.
Look what